Les colloques du Collège de France.
So yes, I think I'm going to be under 30 minutes, that's for sure. So maybe we could have continued with we could return if there is enough time. Yeah? Okay. So, first of all, thank you very much, Louis, for clarifying to me what periphery is. In fact, I had my periphery from Jeanette, but it seems that they're kind of the same thing. So okay, but it's good. I was afraid for a moment that I'm just talking about, literary theory, that nobody will be on board with this, that it's a fake problem. But if Fredeli says so, then okay, we're on the good line. Okay, so here is then the outline. Okay, periphery. A few words about this. I'm going to tell you. And then I said, well, in short, it's going to be something like, well, as you heard, it is fictional, but not really fictional. It's something fictional. Huh? Usually, and this is obviously Pradella's example, he calls it heterodiegetic narrator. I call it extradiegetic narrator from Jeanette. Well, I think he picks up heterodiegetic also from Jeanette, but these are different things. It has to be kept in mind. In fact, I think it's wrong to call Emma heterodiegetic. It's extradiegetic heterodiegetic. Why I think Pradelli is wrong and why I think the Jeanette is wrong. In fact, I want to say that they in fact do belong to the fictional world, but in a liminal way. And then another example is what has this kind of another set of terminology, which honestly, I don't know where Noam comes from. I think it's a film studies thing. And it is good that it is not extra-diegetic because it does signal a different type of non-diegeticness. But it seems that even film studies people will say that although there is some kind of a weird epistemic non-relations between these things, that they will still like music to be involved in this kind of a fictional world. Huh? And at least Wilson will want to do this, no? And Walton, I assume. I don't know if I'll be able to say anything about anything against Walton in the sense that, we'll come to that. Okay, so when we're talking about periphery, as we said, this should be deemed as a fictional entity. So in a sense, I'm going to use here Waltonian framework and say, well, this is something that you're supposed to imagine. No? That's what you're supposed to do with a peripheral, what's called a periphery item. So in the case of narrators, you're supposed to imagine there is somebody telling you the story of Emma, though there is very little what you can ascribe to those people. Huh? And then there is a whole debate about, whether there is this minimal agency if you can ascribe anything beyond existence, no? And even if you should ascribe existence. No? But the point is that they are not a part of the story. Well, we've seen what Pradelli says, they can't kick you in the mouth or something like that. They can, talk shit about you, if they so choose. So that's the part how the narrator operates, and this is how, this is why they use this kind of hyphenated words with extras and nones to tell you, diegesis is whatever the core of this world is, whereas everything else is peripheral. So I'll start with what might probably be a thing that I'll be able to convince you more easily. I'll start with the non-diegetic music. And, usually, could have given you an example, but too late now. So usually it's construed as, this kind of Wagnerian music that depicts the atmosphere, some kind of a leitmotif following characters and so forth. No, but in principle, it's this kind of a music that no agency in the no kind of a anthropomorphic agency in the world that is the core of the fiction, has any kind of a perceptual or epistemic access to it. You know? Nobody can hear this music, nobody is really remembering this music, nobody is, what's it called, you know, there is no recording device or something like playing this music. And of course, you know, films have played with, you know, you think it's non-diegetic, then it turns out to be diegetic and so forth. But we are just sticking now with this, you know, clear examples, you know, classical Hollywood film, a romantic scene ensues, and you know, you hear the, you know, your heart starts to sing along with the harps and violins and whatnot. No? So that's the music that I have in mind. No? Now, clearly, you know, nobody is here denying that this is not part of the work. You know, that is the work of art. You know, I mean, non-diegetic music is a part of the work of art that you appreciate. No? It's not like, say, you know, it's definitely not like, you know, blurb at the end of the book covers or something like that. It's definitely also not like, you know, table of contents in the books. No. Now I start. You know, my first example was like, it's definitely not like the opening credits. But then I started thinking, well, in film, it might be the case. In fact, nowadays, the opening credits are part of the work, no? And they certainly seem to count in the, what's it called, you know, definitions of what running time is. So I started wavering. So I decided to stick and say that, you know, the opening production company credits, you know, when it tells you, you know, Warner Bros., I think that's not a part of the movie, and I think people would agree with that. No? Now, so, what are other kind of examples of non-diegetic stuff? You know, camera movements, something like, some kind of intricate shot, such as the opening of the... So the opening of the that Welles' film with Charlton Heston. What is that called? The Touch of Evil. Yeah, no, there's a whole intricate kind of a camera movement that, you know, it's completely clear that, you know, no camera within this fictional world is somehow following them, no? And it's, you know, the point is to, there are whole kind of a dramatic functions to this camera movement. But again, in principle, nobody ascribes it to the world except Wilson. We'll come to that. And that's the, you know, these are the other typical examples of non-diegetic music. Other things are, you know, color, whether a film is in color or in black and white, usually simply a kind of a technological thing, though even, you know, though some films will, you know, there are some films in which you might think that they are a part of a fictional world, and that's legitimately films like Pleasantville or something like that. That's legitimately an example where, you know, in one moment when film starts, you know, when it switches from black and white to color, that seems to be the change within that fictional world as well. And other examples are like, you know, wipes. Remember Mad Max, you know, the wipes in which you change shots, stuff like Mad Max, Star Wars, and so forth. No? And I think, you know, even Walton would say that that you're not supposed to imagine these things, no? I mean, certainly not these, you know, visual aspects. But there is certainly, you know, one person who seems to object to this. Now, though this is a minority view, it seems to be a very, you know, renowned minority view, so I don't think we can avoid discussing it. So let me just say, I mean, I don't think I'm going to say something terribly new, but there might be a bit of a kind of a variation on the theme, which I think it's worth addressing. Huh? So for Wilson has this whole project, you know, of dealing with how to exactly understand epistemically, you know, the things that are seeing. Can we genuinely say something that we're, you know, seeing fictions? So he really, you know, pulls all the stops in order to defend one version of imagined seeing, And that is essentially the latest kind of version that it comes up with is this kind of a mediated version, where essentially what you're seeing is sort of a, you can think about it as a sort of a fictional recording of the events. It's just that this recording is completely indeterminate how it came about. No? Usually it refers to these things as some kind of naturally iconic images. Naturally iconic images. So essentially, you know, all of these things that you see, all of these things that I said that you're not supposed to imagine, for Wilson, you are supposed to imagine. No? Now, I guess one reason why it would probably be prudent to dismiss this view is that, you know, whatever your alternative view of imagined seeing is, and thankfully I don't need to present one here, but if you have one, it's probably, much more unified and economical, because, for instance, you know, Wilson will say the subjective shots are an exception for him. Eh? So it seems pretty strange that you would eliminate a good subchunk, let's say, of how, what's it called, of how film operates from your theory of what you're supposed to imagine seeing. Eh? So for him, somehow, and he's pretty explicit about this. I can give you a quote if you don't believe me now. I see faces which are, did he really say? I can take my laptop and I'll give it. Okay, but the point is, you know, there is no reason to, you know, have a theory which doesn't cover a pretty common type of representation, you know, in cinema. And then, you know, an alternative way is to say something like, well, you know, even let's say that, you know, subjective shots are then integrated within his proposal, this mediated proposal, which honestly I don't think it's a problem even for him. Honestly, I never quite understood whether he would want to distinguish subjective shots from the mediated ones. But let's say, you know, he manages to integrate them. I think the bigger kind of a calamity for him is, you know, that there is a whole genre of films, which is found footage films, which explicitly operate on the premise that precisely what you're seeing has been made within the fictional world. No? And just because, you know, these genres are so, you know, because in these genres, the mandate is so obviously different from whatever you're supposed to mandate in your average film. It seems to me then, by virtue of that, you know, this is a pretty good evidence that you're not supposed to imagine anything of the sort in your, you know, standard, you know, classical or not so classical Hollywood film. No? And yet, you know, and a kind of a related point to this is, even, you know, even this one example of his when he talks about cachet, he goes to length, well, not so much length, but he devotes to some time to say that, you know, the power of cachet, much of its strength is precisely in the fact that you do not exactly know which, you know, what of the footage there has been recorded from within the fictional world and what it hasn't. No, but again, you know, if that is his statement, then it's unclear how cachet can really have this strength, because by definition you're supposed to imagine everything was recorded somehow from within that fictional world. So, you know, the strength doesn't really work. Huh? So that would be my general view of then why we should still stick with essentially, you know, a claim that, you know, non-diegetic music simply is not a part of the periphery, because you're not supposed to imagine it in any shape, way, or form. You know, you're just supposed to use it to sort of, you know, inform your kind of understanding. You know, you're supposed to use it to inform your imagining of the world. Huh? you know, romantic music is supposed to inform you that, you know, kind of a, that this is a romantic situation. No? But you're not supposed to imagine the music itself. No? Now, okay, so this is then maybe the more controversial part of the talk. So this is why I think, in short, that extra-diegetic narrators are part of the, what's it called, fictional world. And that, in principle, that they can kick you in the face if they wanted to, no? Without any sort of a particularly magical move on their part, no? Now, this kind of a starts from the kind of a Emil Benveniste's account of how deictics operate, no? And you know, there is this kind of a class of words. The classical examples are something like I, here, now, which are essentially referred to as deictics, and they're interesting insofar that, you know, without knowledge of who is speaking or where and when, you can't really fully understand the sentence, no? You can't really fully understand the utterance, no? So if you come across a piece of paper saying something like, you know, yesterday Mary went to the store, you know, if you don't know exactly, you know, at which time this piece of writing was produced, by whom, no? You can't really ascertain what yesterday was, no? So that's the kind of a logic. Huh? Now, here and now are then something like, you know, they're spatial and temporal deictics, because they essentially, you know, the utterances establish a link between, you know, the content of representation and the speaker. Huh? If you say, you know, next to me there is a, you know, there is a bush, no, or something like that. You've established some kind of a special, some kind of a spatial coordinates of proximity between you and the bush. No? If you say, you know, again, you know, now we're going to do this, you've again established some kind of a temporal relations between, you know, the time of your speaking and the action that follows. No? Now, the second step in this kind of argument, is that temporally used, you might be thinking this is a pleonasm, you know, temporally used tense verbs, you know, how are they used? But, you know, just keep in mind, I assure you it's not. So, take a sentence like, cat sat on a mat, no? Now, this is, you know, your standard in English. It's a past simple, no? And if you're using it in a, you know, you can use present simple in a non-temporal sense, no? You can say something like, cats sit on mats, no? This is a general statement about, you know, about what the kind of what's called about what cats usually do. It's not necessarily claiming that at this very moment cats are sitting on mats, though of course they might be, no? And probably are. But so that's the, you know, that's the difference between, you know, temporally using a tensed verb and you know, I'm sure linguists have a better vocabulary here than me, but you know, I assume you get the point, no? But the thing is that past tense verbs oftentimes, most certainly often than present simple, do operate in a, you know, they're usually used in a temporally used sense, no? So, you know, if you're saying cat sat on a mat, no? You are kind of a, what's it called, establishing a sort of a temporal relation between the time of speaking, that is, you know, the present in which you're speaking, and the time at which this cat was sitting on the mat, which was in the past from you. No? That's essentially what you're establishing through this utterance. No? Now, the third point is that, you know, in extra-diegetic narrators like the ones in Emma and many others regularly use tense verbs, you know, and they use them temporarily. Huh? They essentially are talking about agents with some kind of, and this, you know, it doesn't mean that they, I mean, it is most often that they will talk about them in the past tense, no? But, you know, there has been more, you know, quote-unquote experimental literature in which, you know, this may be future, this may be past perfect, you know, whatever you want, it can be shifts in time. The point here is simply that they are using it in a temp, you know, in a temporal way, no? They're not using it in a general way of, you know, cats sit on mats, no? And then from, you know, if we take this to be the case, then it follows that essentially that, you know, the events that are narrated by extradiegetic narrators are temporally related to extradiegetic narrators themselves, no? They, by virtue of narrating them via, tense verbs which are used temporally, they're establishing a temporal relation towards that narrated event, no? And, you know, if you take a fictional world to be some kind of a spatial-temporal continuum, then essentially, you know, you've established that the extradiegetic narrator has, you know, however vague the relation might be, you know, simply, you know, it's in the past from the narrator, they have established a sort of a, well, not sort of, they have established a temporal relations towards the narrative events. And in doing so, they have made themselves a part of that fictional world, no? Now, this is a, you know, you might not be able to specify the coordinates with much precision, but, you know, they are in the space of you know, they are in the realm of that world, no? So that's the logic, huh? So, okay. So just, you know, to give you a sort of a, you know, potential objection, and that's probably the response would be something like, well, you know, sure, but, you know, maybe you've jumped the gun, maybe they're not really used in a temporal sense, you know, this is just a convention, you know, it's just a convention that most often, you know, extradiegetic narrators speak in the past tense, no? And what is really being conveyed is not some kind of a, it's not being conveyed that this happened in the past or something like that, relative to the narrator in question. What is really being conveyed, you know, is a sort of a proposition, you know? When, you know, Emma, well, you know, when it's said that, you know, Emma was obnoxious or something like that, no? Then, you know, what is really being in a kind of a logical sense meant, you know, in a sense that you're really supposed to imagine, you're not supposed to imagine that, you know, she did it in the past or something like that, no? Rather that, you know, something, you know, this would be the kind of argument, rather what you're supposed to imagine that, you know, at some point in time, Emma is being obnoxious, something like that, you know? Or Emma is just, you know, presently obnoxious at some point in time, no? Doesn't really matter what this point in time is, no? But, you know, as a sort of a rejoinder to that, I would say, you know, it kind of plays fast and loose with how the, you know, with that it does matter for, you know, proper engagement with fictional works how narrators speak, you know? It does matter the full kind of meaning of their words, so to speak, the full, you know, the full range of expression at their disposal, no? So for instance, you know, if you were to have a first-person narrator who is also, let's call them, you know, first-person heterodiegetic narrator who tells you a lot about themselves, no? And is also extradiegetic, but can be heterodiegetic. You know, it doesn't seem one would make a move in which they would deny that, you know, when they speak in the past, that this is merely some kind of a convention. You would ascribe, you know, the fullness of the way they speak to them, no? So in that sense, you know, it seems to me that it seems to be a sort of a, you know, an ad hoc move to say that, that, you know, we're free to do that in the case of, quote-unquote, third-person narrators, which are also, in fact, first person editors. I mean, there is no such thing as third person editors. So it seems to me to be a sort of ad hoc move to say that, you know, you shouldn't kind of fully, yeah, I'm done, that you shouldn't fully essentially, you know, take them at their full meaning, you know? And this full meaning does involve a kind of a establishment of temporal relations. Okay, that's about it from me. Thanks. We can go to lunch.
Collège de France, le savoir en illimité. Retrouvez tous nos contenus audio et vidéo sur notre site collège-de-france.fr, les plateformes de podcast et nos chaînes YouTube.